I am going to stand here because so I can point at my slides. So let me just see if that works. No, it doesn't. Thank you for inviting me. I would like to take you now on a walk along the Danube. Okay, we will start here in Hungary, and then we will walk up the Danube, and we will end up in Bavaria. And this is when I was putting this talk together. It was quite interesting for me because it's kind of a reverse of the journey that my own research has taken. So we will start with the kind of work I'm doing at the moment, and then we will go back to some things that I did a few years ago. So maybe just to start with, it's quite good for us to think about the kinds of issues we're dealing with when we're talking about questions of ethnic identity in the early Middle Ages. Okay. So one of the problems that we're dealing with is the circular argument of what's called the ethnic paradigm. Okay. And it starts with archaeologists generally reading historical sources in a very bad way. Okay, so we're archaeologists, we're not historians. And what we like to do is we take little bits of text and then we think we understand it and we use that. Okay? So we start up here, okay? And then on the basis of this, we then extrapolate ideas about the migrations of past populations and also of the locations of tribal territories. Okay? Then we end up with nice coloured maps, like here. Sometimes we also have maps with arrows, so we have the kind of spaghetti bowl type arrow, okay? And then we go back to the material culture. So very popular are the brooches. So we link from here the maps where we think we know where people were, you know, the Goths, the Franks, and then we feed that back to our artifacts, so we make that connection again. So then when we excavate graves. Up here is an individual with Gothic brooches, and we go, okay, we've got a Goth, we've got it sorted, okay? And in that way, we feed right back into the story of the historical sources, okay? Now, clearly there is a problem, because at each stage, we kind of back up what was before, but in itself, if there's a problem, in there, then it never gets revealed because each component just supports everything else. Now, to try to get away from this, and the approach that I've taken is one that focuses on practice. So I think it can be very helpful to think about what people do and not so much how we assign ethnicity from the outside, but we can look at what people did in the past. And then we can, on the basis of that, assume that what people did gave them some kind of identity, some kind of sense of belonging to a group. Okay, so specifically, some of the questions that I'm interested in is how did populations interact across the late and post-Roman frontier zone, and then how does this relate to identity in burial practice? So, one of the ways in which I'm trying to approach this at the moment is using isotope analysis. I'm not sure how familiar you are with the methodology, so I just want to quickly take you through how some of that works. So very simply, it's based on the idea that you are what you eat or drink. Okay? So we can undertake biochemical analysis of body tissues, and from that we can get information about food or water that was consumed by populations in the past. Now, because I'm interested in practice and in what people did, I'm also very interested in subsistence practices in the past and diet in the past. So for most of my work, I focus on the so-called dietary isotopes, carbon and nitrogen. So just to quickly sum up what each of them can tell us, carbon isotopes can tell us about, can give us information about different kinds of plants based on the different types of photosynthesis that these plants utilize. So principally we can divide that into what's called the C3 and what's called the C4 photosynthetic pathway. And all we need to take away from this now is that isotopically there's a very clear distinction. So the C3 plants fall into a very distinct isotopic group, and the C4 plants fall into a very distinct isotopic group, which is something that's very helpful in undertaking isotope analysis and then trying to extrapolate diet. Okay. Now, most cultivated plants in Europe, and in fact all over the world, are C3 plants. For us, the kind of main plant of interest that is a C4 plant is millet in Europe. In North America, maize is also interesting. Then we have other plants that humans use, like sago and sugarcane. But in our period, only millet is really relevant. And I'll come back to millet later on. Now, when we're looking at nitrogen isotopes, that very simply can tell us about the amount of animal protein that a person or also an animal has in the diet. So the more carnivorous an organism is, the higher the nitrogen isotope levels. And crucial also is that animal protein comes not only from meat, but also from milk. Now, I'm interested in populations in the Carpathian Basin. And in the 5th century, as early and also later, we have an influx of populations that follow a nomadic pastoralist type of lifestyle. And that is something that is... So here we have, on the one hand, nomadic pastoralists, on the other hand, settled agriculturalists. So we have two modes of a diet and subsistence that potentially can be distinguished through their isotopes. Okay. And how that would look in practice is that, just want to remind you, so in generally when you're looking at isotope data, you will find your carbon on your x-axis, okay, and then again you can distinguish here between millet, so millet is panicum, okay, and then we can distinguish other types of plants, including wheat, other cereals, and legumes. So they kind of fall on this axis. And then we have nitrogen, that's on the y-axis, okay? So the more animal protein, the higher we will be here, okay? So the hypothesis is, when we are thinking now about two distinct populations, agriculturalists on the one hand, and nomadic pastoralists on the other hand, that we might expect the agriculturalists to be somewhere on this side. Okay? So they don't consume a lot of a very high amount of animal protein, and they have a pretty diverse diet based on wheat, cereals, legumes. Okay? Now, isotopically, this kind of agriculturalist diet is quite well characterized. So we've got quite a lot of studies in the early medieval period in Europe. So we know that that falls pretty much here. When we are looking at diet of nomadic pastoralists, it gets a bit more difficult because there aren't that many isotope studies. So we have to fall back on analogies from ethnographies. Okay. So when we're looking at what people get up to in modern day Mongolia, for example, they consume a lot of milk, they consume a lot of meat, and interestingly also, they consume millet. Okay? And that is because millet is a kind of grain that you can just throw in the ground, you can come back 6 weeks later, and it will have harvested. So for a mobile population, that's very useful. Also, when we are looking at archaeobotanical evidence, in the 5th century, we know from that period that there's an increase in millet in the Carpathian Basin. So there is another indicator there that there is something happening there where millet becomes relevant. So we can assume on that basis that our nomadic pastoralist diet will be somewhere up here. Okay? So agriculturalists here, and nomadic pastoralist diet somewhere here. Okay? Now, the other thing that's interesting methodologically with isotope studies is that by sampling different parts of the human body, we can get an insight into different time windows during a person's life. Okay? So if we sample teeth, so that could be dentine, so the tooth roots, but also tooth enamel, that will give us an insight into people's diet during their childhood and early adulthood. Okay? The reason being that once the teeth are fully formed, they don't change. Okay? So you get a hole in your tooth, you get caries, everybody knows that's it, you have to go to the dentist. Okay? If we, on the other hand, sample bones, that gives us an insight into diet towards the later part of a person's life. So round about 10 years before death, but it's a kind of lifetime average that is geared towards the later part of a person's life. Why is that? Well, because the human skeleton is constantly remodeled. Okay, you break a bone, your bone heals. Right? So that gives us the potential of two or maybe even more time windows into a person's life. So I say more than two because by sampling two different types of teeth, and I have done that, so I've looked at the second premolar and then the third molar, the wisdom tooth, that gives you two quite small time windows during early adulthood, and then by looking at bones, we can get a third time window later in life. Yes, and then this information can then be related back to identities in the burial practice. Now, okay, so let's look at some of the sites that I've been investigating. So here is a picture of the late Roman frontier in around the 5th century, okay? And I've picked out four sites. You can see here that they go across the frontier zone. So we've got Cascade here, Yerv, Merge, and Sonok. And I've picked out these four because they go across this whole frontier zone. Okay, so it gives us a very good way of comparing subsistence strategies across this region. But in the talk today, because I'm limited with time, I'm going to focus particularly on Merge. This is also a very interesting site. Okay. So, here, however, is a summary of some of the isotope evidence that has come out of this project. Okay. So we've got, what you can see here, is the four Hungarian sites, and just for comparison, I've also included two sites in Bavaria that I've worked on previously and that I will talk about a little bit later. So to remind you, we've got carbon on the x-axis, nitrogen on the y-axis. And so when we're looking at this little cluster here, these are our sites in Bavaria. And these sites, these are pretty well characterized as a settled population and an agriculturalist population. And you can see this kind of is over there in quite a nice cluster. When we now look at the Hungarian sites, the first thing that comes to mind is that the data is really spread out. Okay, so there's a high variability. Also, all of these are to the right of these ones, so suggesting that there's a significant input of C4 plants in the diet already. Another thing to note is that nitrogen levels are in some cases elevated relative to this group. Okay. So this broad picture already confirms some of my hypotheses. Okay, we've got variability, we've got C4 plant, and we've got in some cases elevated nitrogen levels. So there's a suggestion here already that people follow quite a different subsistence strategy. And there's also a suggestion that this might be to do with pastoralism and nomadism in some form. And the other thing, just to bear in mind, because it will be relevant later, is where I circled these symbols, indicate individuals with skull modification, and I'll come back to that later. Right, okay, so let's look at the site of Meurs. This is a really great site because it was completely excavated. So there's this earlier part here that was excavated in the 1960s, and then this much bigger cemetery, southern part of the cemetery, that was excavated in the early 2000s, I think, yeah? And the really great thing is that there's also a settlement associated with it that was also completely excavated. Now, for the purpose of this project here, at the moment I have only sampled this little group up there, okay? Maybe at some point we'll be able to include this as well. So here's a close-up of this little group. What we have here is that we have 27 graves, a substantial number of individuals with skull modification, that is the number, that fat symbol, okay? So wherever these symbols are, you know, thicker, those are with skull modification. Also, we've got a significant number of graves that are brick-lined. And now, brick-lined graves, that's the kind of practice that is associated with late antique practices. So also something to bear in mind. Now, isotopically, I would just like to remind you, so I sampled teeth, dentine, from two different teeth, the second molar and the third molar, and I sampled collagen from ribs. So you have a kind of spaghetti plot here. I just want to make that a bit clearer because, so for example, this number 27 is one individual where we have two teeth, so the M2, the M3, and then rib collagen. In some cases, like this one, the 1-5, I've only got two samples per individual. It just depended on what was available. Okay. So, to explain this now, first thing that we can see is that we have three clusters of data. Okay. We have this one, we have this one, and then we have one in the middle. And when we're looking at individuals 27 and then also 18 here, both of these have a kind of diet in their childhood that then changes from their teeth to their rib collagen, and it changes quite significantly. So we go from here to here, we go from here to here. So then there's a cluster here. All the little rectangles indicate rib collagen. Okay. So the hypothesis now is that that this central group is the diet that was local to this site at Meurs, okay? Because the reason being that most of the rib collagen falls in here. So when we go back to here, then we can hypothesize that we have two groups that at some point in their childhood or early adulthood had a different diet, okay? And then at some point they moved. After the formation of their teeth, they moved, and then that diet ended up being like that. Okay. So the best examples are the 18 and the 27. The 12 is also quite good. Even this number 6 kind of moves in that direction. Okay. Is that quite clear? Yeah. Okay. Now let's go to the grave goods. Okay. I just want to remind you of the 7, 6, 7, and 12. Right. They're all over here. Now 6, 7 and 12 are three women with very similar grave goods here. They just have some combs and some earrings. And in the location of the cemetery they are here, they're next to each other. So it's very interesting because we have this group of individuals that were at some point early in their lives in terms of their diet that was quite similar. Also I have to say that these enriched carbon levels here from 16 to minus 16 to minus 14, that is really quite enriched. So anywhere in kind of Western, Central Western Europe, that is extremely unusual. Okay, so here there's really a significant amount of C4 plant in the diet. So on the basis of these growth groups, there's nothing too kind of special. There's not really very much we can say about ethnicity or migration, but it's interesting that they are a group. They are also buried together, and it appears that they had a similar diet during their childhood and then moved to the area of Meurthe, and apparently then, or we can hypothesize that they moved together. Now, let's look at this one here. Okay, grave number 11. Here are the grave goods. Okay, the excavators at the time, they pointed out that this individual is quite different from the others, okay, because of the orientation and also the grave goods. So they identified this as the Hun. Okay. Well, what's interesting is when we look at where that one is, it's right in there. Okay. And so this is not the rib collagen, this is one of the teeth. So I think what we can pull out from this is that on the one hand we have evidence for a change in subsistence practice, then we have evidence for change in location at some point in individuals' lives, okay? But that doesn't tie in with the manner in which they were buried. So there's a separate story that we can derive from the grave goods. And I think it's just an important lesson that really, the kind of interpretations we might make on the basis of grave goods alone, it doesn't work. We need to bring other things into this. Okay, so moving on now. So I mentioned skull deformation earlier. Skull deformation is, I think it's really cool because it's just so fascinating, So this is something that's very common in the early medieval period. It appears in Europe in about the 1st, 2nd century AD in the Black Sea region, and then we find this practice moving westwards. So in the 5th century in the Carpathian Basin, it's very common. What it is that, so when a baby's born, the bones of the skull are still very soft, and they are kind of, they can be shaped quite easily. So at that point, if you shake the head of a baby by massaging and by using bandages and binding, then the head of the baby can be given a different shape. And then by about 3 to 5 years of age, the skull bones will be fully fused, so that this new shape of the head will stay with an individual for the rest of their lives. And this is a practice that is actually, at different times, was quite common all over the world. So I put up here examples from ethnographic contexts, and this poor little child here with the boards on its head. And then here's just an idea of how that might work in our period. And this one is also very nice because this is actually a child with modified skull. Okay. Now, for our purposes, I think skull modification is very interesting because it's obviously a cultural or a social practice that changes a person's appearance. So they will look physically different, but it's not something like tattooing that maybe someone did as an adult, but something that happened to them when they were children. And then for the rest of their lives, they will look like that. So it's a very interesting integration of kind of phenotype appearance on the one hand and cultural practice on the other hand. Okay, so this is a map of modified skulls across Europe. Okay, now, principally, what I would like... I'll just carry on talking, okay? So principally what I would like you to look at is that when we're looking at these individuals with skull modification in the Carpathian Basin, what you can see is a lot of white dots and then hopefully also yellow and red ones. Okay, red are women, yellow are men, and white ones are sex unknown, so that would be many children. Okay, so the key thing to take away from this is that in this area we have... Oh yeah, much better. So we have both sexes represented and also children. Now when we're looking at what is happening west, further west, What comes out, especially here in Germany and France, is that we almost only have red dots, some yellow ones, and very, very few white ones. Okay, so almost no children, and pretty much only women. So socially, something quite different is happening here. Right. So when we look at the demography or the age of death a bit more closely, this comes out again. So black is just a representation of a kind of standard early people cemetery, so the distribution of the ages of death. So we have here death during childhood, then it goes up during adulthood, and sinks off like that. So looking at green and yellow, so that would be Hungary and Lower Austria and Moravia. That follows pretty much that pattern, okay? So the demography is very similar to your kind of normal medieval cemetery. However, when we're now looking at blue and red, so that would be Bavaria and Central Germany, so this big group and this group, okay? You see there are no children at all, right? So that now it gets really interesting, because what does that mean? Well, what it means is that we have here a practice that does not get transmitted through to childhood. So it's a kind of one generational thing, and it stops at one generation. Okay? Because otherwise we would have children as well with this kind of modification. So we have skull modification limited to adult women, doesn't get transmitted through to childhood. Okay? So at this point I start building a hypothesis. So what is we can hypothesize that individuals perhaps moved from this region to this region, adult women only. Well, perhaps it is something to do with marriage practices. Okay. So now we are getting to our cemeteries in Bavaria, right? Where we also have some cases of individuals with skull modification. So there's the cemetery of Ivan Erding, when we have five of these individuals, okay, circled again like that. Again, here's a plot of our isotopic evidence, carbon here, nitrogen here. And this is from rib collagen. So what we can see is that there is a big cluster here, a relatively homogeneous diet, men, women have the same kind of diet, and then we have four outliers here that are shifted towards enrichment of carbon isotopes. And two of these have skull modification. Okay. Now, to try to refine this picture, what happens? Oh, yes, so our standard kind of diet of the population in general, and then our outliers. Another site I looked at was the cemetery of Straubing. Here, what you can see is I've picked out the individuals that dated to the 5th and the early 6th century, and then the open symbols are the later period. And here you can see again that there's a kind of dietary cluster, a bit like before, okay? Similar thing. Interestingly, here, the individuals with skull modification are right in the middle of this kind of average diet. Okay? Again, I want to remind you that this is to do with the rib collagen only. Now, okay, it gets a bit crazy, because now I plotted information from the ribs against information from enamel apatite. Okay, so our ribs, and this is carbon only, so nitrogen has fallen away. So we've got carbon here and carbon here, the ribs down here, and the enamel apatite here. Okay? Again, we've got our average kind of diet, and then we've got the same outliers up here, same as before, in terms of the carbon values from the ribs. Now, when we're looking at the enamel apatite from the teeth, we can see that there are also outliers up here. Okay, so these are from the site of Straubing. Here, we couldn't see them, but when we are now looking at their teeth, we can see that here too, there are outliers, and again, the outliers are in terms of their carbon isotope values. Okay, now let's look back at the information from all the sites together, the Hungarian and the Bavarian sites. So where are our Bavarian individuals? Well, they are here and here, okay? And this is, again, just the rib collagen, okay? Now it gets interesting because these guys now are no longer outliers, okay? They fall into this general kind of diet that we find in the Carpathian Basin. So what can we make of this? Well, at this point now we have to be very careful because the thing that we maybe want to say straight away is, oh, they moved from here to here, but that's the thing that in the first instance we can't say, okay? All we can say is they had a diet that was similar to the diet that people had in this location. However, we know on the basis of the skull modification that there was a chronological movement from east to west. And also when we look at archaeobotanical evidence on that basis, we know that in southern Germany and France, there's relatively little evidence for millet, but there is a good amount of evidence for millet in the Carpathian Basin. So on the basis of this associated evidence, maybe we can say that we can see here a movement from a region where this kind of diet was consumed to over here. Okay, so possibly a movement from the Carpathian Basin to Bavaria. Where's my clicker? Okay. Right. Now, getting back to the hypothesis of exogamy. Okay, so how does this fit in socially? So I've pulled out some information about the role of marriage in the early medieval period. So this is from Frankish legal texts. And again, I might be there might be a danger now of kind of in a very poor way pulling information out from historical sources. So historians may criticize me for this. But basically, very simply, what I want you to take from this is that we have to think of marriage in the early medieval period as a kind of financial or economic interaction. Okay. So at the point when marriage was contracted, there were various gifts that were being given to the woman from, on the one hand, her father, and on the other hand, from her husband. And the purpose then of marriage was the creation of legitimate children. And these legitimate children were the ones only that could inherit. Okay? So there is an economic aspect to this marriage that's very important. And the other thing is that married women retained links with their original family and then created links, of course, with their new married family into which they married. So I think they played a very important social role as connectors of two families. Right, now let's go back to the archaeology where I'm a bit stronger. Okay, so back to the site of Eisen Erding. These red stars are our individuals with skull modification. What you can see here is, number one, they are not buried all together, okay, so they are all over the cemetery. And also, they are not buried somewhere outside. Okay, so even though they looked a bit strange, but they were buried right in the middle of the cemetery with everybody else. Now, another thing to take from this is that I analysed the location of grave goods in, I analysed the burial practices in the cemetery of Eisen Erding, kind of in a chronological way, and looked at the location of different types of grave goods. And I was able to identify repeating groups of artefacts that were carried in the same areas. So, for example, in this area we have a kind of repeating group of artifacts that of Ostrogothic brooches and these different S brooches. And in this area we have Frankish brooches. Up here also we have Frankish ones. And here we have Thuringian brooches and here also. And the interesting thing is that this repetition of similar artifacts happen over a long period of time. But also significantly, these are just the female graves, okay? So we find this kind of repetition of artifacts only in the female graves, and not in the male ones. There isn't, you know, that patterning doesn't come out. Now when we go back to thinking about marriage and these connections, and then also I would like you to just consider the great variety of these brooches, okay? And maybe just in the variety of these brooch cells we can see connections that are being made with faraway places. So I'm not saying that these women, you know, moved from northern Italy or from Thuringia, okay, but let's say the artifacts moved, but the artifacts made these connections. And the other thing we can draw out is that I think through this repeated use of similar artifacts, we may be able to see kinship groups within the cemetery. Okay? So we have kinship groups signified in female graves, and then we have these links with faraway places, and then we have associated evidence for exogamy. Okay? So we can see that something very important is happening with these female graves. Okay, because within the female graves are like the kind of nexus for these connections, lots of connections, with the family on the one hand and then with faraway places. So then we go on. So this is another thing very important. So when we're looking at the so-called Gothic brooches, right? It's also important to bear in mind, okay, that brooches were used. They were practical objects, okay? They were used in some form associated with dress. And it's very crucial that the kind of dress that we can see in different locations, like in Hungary, so here we have our Peklos dress, then we have the kind of classic Central European German style of the brooches on the body, and then in France we've got different examples, you know, Gothic brooches, more like that, and more in the Peklos style. So it's just important, I think, also to bear in mind that the position of these brooches on the body, the kind of dress that people were wearing, was maybe more significant than the metalwork that was used. And it's just that for us, of course, now we just see the shiny metal objects and we really like them, and we can't see the clothes. But in fact, the clothes may have been more important. So this is just something to bear in mind. Right, okay, so as we go on, then in the 6th century, we still find these burial groups maintained. Interestingly, also, we see them in male graves at this point. So we find repetitions of different kinds of belt sets within these areas. And then we go into the 7th century, and this disappears suddenly, okay? So the 7th century is really characterized by a much greater homogeneity of artifacts. So we lose the variation in the styles, and also we just lose the variation across the cemetery. And now I just want to kind of make an arc from, we started in the 5th century, now we're getting to the 7th century, because this homogenization is something that happens throughout. Okay, so we can see a kind of referencing at this point now of what I call Romanitas, and I think of just as a kind of reimagining of something Roman in some sense, or also maybe a reimagining of Byzantine styles. So at this point, we lose our the brooches, you know, the double brooches or the four brooches in some cases, and we just have individual ones here. And interesting also to me is that this shift in burial practice is not something that we only see in Germany, but it's something, if there's a similar shift taking place as far away as Anglo-Saxon England, to this greater uniformity and this referencing of Roman styles or Byzantine styles, or a kind of imagining of these styles. And here also, we have a referencing of imperial fashions. This is actually a very poor drawing of this, but here we just see lots of beads And the idea was maybe that there was a referencing of this sewn on bead collar that we see on the mosaic of Theodora and also on things like the shirt of St. Balthild. So kind of as we then go on, I think early on when we looked at the, in the 5th century, the brick-lined graves, we still have a kind of residual experience of late Roman traditions that were kind of used and melded in some way. And then as we go on into the 7th century, I think we find again a very kind of active reuse and reshaping of imperial ideas to do with a kind of Roman past. And just to conclude here, just some conclusions that I would like to draw out of this. So what can we tell then about identity during this period? Well, for a start, I think we can say that mobility influences identity in very complex ways. So there isn't a straightforward link. Also, we need to bear in mind that different forms of evidence, so the isotope evidence, the artifact evidence, they can sometimes contradict, okay? And I think that's a good thing, because it just means that we need to think even harder about what's going on. The other thing is that we can see that there's a very close relationship with gender and kinship identities, and then there's an ongoing kind of reimagining or reshaping of ideas to do with the Roman heritage or Romanitas in the broadest sense. Okay, thank you very much.